The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Well, that took a while, didn't it? 352 days since the 2019-20 Premier League season began, and it's all over. Chelsea and Manchester United join Manchester City and champions Liverpool in the Champions League. At the bottom, Watford give Arsenal a three-goal start before giving it a good go. Bournemouth's win isn't enough as Aston Villa's talisman Jack Grealish scores another vital goal for them. Spurs' disastrous season ends in Europa League football, while Wolves' brilliant season might not. We'll try and work out the best game, goal and player of the season. Remember, don't be annoyed by our choices. They don't really matter. And we'll take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Hi, Max.
How are you? Nice to see you.
I'm pretty good. I'm pretty excited since you sort of gave the green light to this being a slightly boozy pod.
Absolutely.
Which always sort of makes me slightly happier about things.
So I should be clear for the tape that we are recording at 7:15 on Sunday evening. How much drink has been taken by you, Lars Sivertsen?
Less than you'd think, but I've recently, just now, because I did, at the start of the season, have a slight bet on Jamie Vardy finishing top scorer. And so in honour of the great Sir Jamie of Vardy coming through for me on that one, I have had a vodka and energy drink thing going here now. So there's not been a lot, but what there has been enormously potent.
What an absolutely shameful choice for a Sunday evening. Jonathan Wilson, I hope... I'm in despairing at the thought of having a vodka and Red Bull on a Sunday evening just before doing a podcast. Jonathan Wilson, a sobriety test for you?
I am currently totally sober.
Excellent.
That was not true 24 hours ago, but it is true now.
Well, you're a professional. The same question...
I wouldn't go that far.
The same question to Barry Glendening.
I'm sober as such. I've had 3 pints. Okay. And since having the 3 pints, I've had a pie in a can with chips and peas.
Just so you know, Barry, that voice that you put on there, the sort of slurry pretend drunk, is exactly the same voice as your actual slurry drunk, for example, on the train back from Manchester after that. After that live show that you don't remember as well as the rest of us. For the record, 3 small cans of Pilsner Urquell here. But, you know, they're unlikely to sponsor us, so I'll say it's a fancy craft beer and maybe they'll give us some money. Okay, then. Obviously, this season, memorable because of a pandemic. But was it a good Premier League season, Wilson?
I mean, I think Liverpool, although they've sort of stuttered a bit since, well, even before the shutdown, they were stuttering a bit. But there was a time in November, December when they were genuinely playing some of the best football I think we've ever seen in the Premier League. So from that point of view, it's been a good season. I think the race for third's been quite interesting. And you know, it's the lowest tally of points for third place team in a decade, I think, something like that. And then the battle for relegation was pretty interesting as well. So it's been okay. I don't think it's been great. I don't think it's been terrible. But yeah, Liverpool certainly at times were genuinely exceptional.
I got really cross because for a period during lockdown, there was this sort of small movement of oddballs on the internet who insisted that the season would always have an asterisk next to it. Liverpool's title would never be fully valid because of the lockdown and all this. But I honestly think, obviously we'll remember it for the lockdown, but for me, seeing Liverpool win the title again and seeing this sort of thing Jurgen Klopp was building towards come to fruition, just because I think he seems like a nice guy. I like his outlook on life. I like his outlook on football, and as a sort of counter argument to the fact that you don't have to be a sort of a cynical, awful person to be a good football manager. Now, I'm sure he has that side as well, but that whole project makes me feel happy, and I'm very happy that he
broke the code.
Yeah, he did.
He broke the code.
I mean, just enormous Tim Sherwood energy out of Frank Lampard this week, you have to say, with sort of in his second full season as a manager, lecturing Jurgen Klopp on how to behave on the sideline. That was interesting.
It's a problem when you have foreign managers coming in like Klopp, like Marcelo Bielsa, and they don't know the code.
Yeah,
so what,
for sure.
What we need, you know, if Frank Lampard really wants to help those managers settle in the English game, as I'm sure he does, we need Lampard to spend, you know, this short break between seasons writing a catechism to lay out precisely what that code entails. And that can be distributed to managers whenever they get a job. And then everybody knows what the code is and it'll be a lot easier.
I think they really should be shown instructional videos. Let's say, for example, from, you know, Frank Lampard's heyday as a player when he was playing at Chelsea with Jose Mourinho and Rui Faria sort of roaming the touchline. And that would be the model of behavior to follow. But in all seriousness and without being snide, it was great seeing this Liverpool team under Jurgen Klopp win the league the way they did. And it was unfortunate that it was interrupted. It was unfortunate that the fans couldn't be at Anfield when they lifted the trophy. But that is something I'll remember this season for.
Is it unfortunate, Barry, that City didn't push them a little bit more? I mean, they were scintillating at times, Liverpool.
Well, even if City had pushed them a little bit more, City would still have lost the title by at least 10 points. I don't think there's any harm in a team running away with the league. I can't remember a team, I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but in my lifetime, a team winning a title as emphatically as Liverpool has done this season.
No team has ever had a 25-point lead, which was the maximum Liverpool's lead got to.
Right.
No team's ever won it as early. No team's ever had a lead that big.
So I don't think that detracts. I think if it happened again next season, yes, that would curtail my enjoyment and not necessarily be a good thing. You know, Celtic winning the title at a canter every season in Scotland is tedious. And it's, you know, I think it's fallacious to say otherwise. But I like watching good teams play. City are an excellent team as well. They've just, you know, they left themselves short personnel-wise at the back and had a few too many bad days. Liverpool barely had any, apart from that game against Watford. They were home and hosed. They didn't and took their foot off the gas, which is quite understandable. They barely had a bad game. I don't think it detracts from whether it's it being a good season if one team runs away with it in such emphatic fashion.
Shall we talk about the games then today? We'll start with those European places. So it was between Manchester United, Leicester, and Chelsea to get third and fourth. Manchester United end up finishing third. Chelsea finishing fourth on the same number of points because Manchester United won at Leicester in a game, Wilson, that was pretty flat, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, Leicester, to be honest, haven't been very good at all for quite a while. It's easy to say lockdown disrupted their rhythm, but actually, if you look back, although they won that very last game before lockdown, they beat Villa 4-0. Is that right? Yeah. I think they only won three of the last 14 games. So their decline, which I think is partly regression to the mean. I think it's partly to do with injuries in key areas. I think it's partly to do with teams working them out a little bit and sitting a bit deeper against them, which then coincides with not having James Maddison because of a hip injury. So, you know, I think there's a number of factors there why they've declined that I don't think sort of devalues how good a season this still has been for them. I mean, you know, for Leicester to finish fifth, they've only done that once since 1963. I mean, they happened to win the title that year, but In sort of historic Leicester terms, this is, you know, their second best season in 57 years. So it's still been a good season, even if it's probably feels a bit disappointing now, given that they were 8 points clear of fifth going into lockdown. But yeah, they never really got going today. And you always sort of thought United would... United didn't need to score, but you also felt they would at some point.
Richard Foster tweets, Manchester United's win over Leicester is their 666th in the Premier League. Perfect for the Red Devils. Anthony Martial winning that penalty. Would you, Barry, like to be double teamed by Johnny Evan and Wes Morgan?
Crikey. Oh, behave, matron. I wasn't sure about that. Johnny Evans got the yellow card for that. I think it was Wes Morgan's tackle. I'll stand corrected on that.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think they booked. He booked Johnny Evans originally. I wondered when VAR looked at it, he might say, actually, Evans got the ball, but Morgan had already clattered him.
But then Johnny Evans got sent off. But I think that was a straight red because he didn't show the second yellow. So anyway, it doesn't really matter. It was the game I was kind of focusing on most intently and probably one of the worst of the day. They both looked leggy and tired. I think it's a very important win for Manchester United. They've been on a good run, but the quality of opposition they've faced has been fairly poor. And the two best teams they've faced, I think, since, or three best teams, if you include Chelsea in the Cup, they've lost against them. They drew with Southampton and drew with Spurs, if I'm not mistaken. So their results, while good, you can only beat what's in front of you, obviously. There haven't really been any signature statement performances. So I think it was very important for them to win this one today, and they won it pretty comfortably.
Their 14th penalty of the season, a Premier League record. John says, how many penalties do Manchester United need to be awarded next season to mount a serious title challenge?
I saw people complaining about this on Twitter, about the number of penalties Manchester United get. Now, I can't remember all of them, but that today was a penalty, you know, so they deserve to get a penalty for it. Most of the penalties they've got have been penalties, so it's not really a legitimate complaint. They're not getting wrong decisions in their favour.
And they also have a lot of fast guys up front. I mean, that's been a thing for Solskjaer ever since he took over at Man United. He wanted to attack with pace. He wanted to give a lot of playing time to the quick guys as opposed to other players. And if you have a lot of fast guys who run into the area a lot, you're probably going to get more penalties than a lot of the other teams. I mean, it just stands to reason. I thought the game looked like one team that was losing almost, that was missing almost half of their first choice outfield, and one team that was really tired, because that is what it was. And I think Solskjaer has been criticized for not rotating, but I'll say, I mean, if he had played since lockdown a bunch of games with Jesse Lingard instead of Bruno Fernandes and Dan Jones instead of Martial, you know, they might not have been in a position where they were 1 point away from the Champions League. So I think he does actually deserve some credit for just finally finding an 11 that really worked for them and sticking with it, because in the end that came through.
And Lars, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, right? Obviously, you are, he's the king of Norway. But I am surprised that he kept his job earlier in the season. I had written him off. I think it's fair to say, Barry, you'd written him off. I don't know if you had, Jonathan. And you still have. Okay, well, let's go with that then. You still have.
Well, okay, no. The question I'd ask, Mauricio Pochettino is available. Would he be an upgrade? And I cannot see how you can possibly say he wouldn't be an upgrade. So, you know, when I said Solskjaer was the worst manager in the Premier League, I may have been slightly exaggerating to make a point, but I can't see United particularly improving on their position now with Solskjaer as a manager.
The question you kind of have to ask is, you know, what are Manchester United fans prepared to settle for? They might win an FA Cup, they might win League Cups. They're not. You can't see them winning the league under Solskjaer. He's done okay. I wouldn't say he's done a brilliant job, but he's done all right.
So I believe I agree in theory with Wilson. I do believe all things being equal, Mauricio Pochettino is a better manager than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and there's probably other better managers on paper that they could get. But I think something that's worth noting is that even when things were going really wrong, you didn't get a lot of stories suggesting the players were unhappy with him. You didn't get a lot of stories suggesting the players thought he was an idiot. It does seem like the players are kind of sticking with him and that the players kind of believe in what they're doing. And at these big clubs, that has a lot. That means a lot, getting buy-in from the squad. And if the players are happy with the direction they're going in, that should count for something, I think. And I definitely see the logic. If Pochettino's available, perhaps you should get him. But after they brought in Bruno Fernandes, they haven't lost a lot of games. I mean, their points average and their results since January has been very, very good. And I think you'd want to give it a season, certainly in this configuration, and see what it can do.
Yeah, I mean, my worry would be, and you know, this sort of leads on to what you were saying earlier about he's found an 11 that works. Well, okay, that's fine. But that's not all you have to do in modern management. You also have to work out, and partly to do with squad composition, but you have to be able to rotate. And particularly when you're being asked to play 10 games in 5 weeks or whatever it was, rotating is part of your job. And okay, he took a gamble on, let's go ahead and see him and keep going. But you know, the truth is, they haven't played very well the last, five games, and they weren't very good against Southampton when they drew. The Palace game, they were a bit lucky to win that. You know, two brilliant goals, an otherwise drab game.
But no one's disagreeing they ran out of steam. I mean, that was fairly obvious. The question is, to rotate, you need a squad to work with, and you need the players to come in to be able to do a job. And I think results sort of pre-Bruno's appearance and pre-Pogba coming back would seem to suggest that perhaps the players that are there that weren't playing now in this period were maybe not that good.
Well, sure, but I think you have to be clever enough to make, you know, to change one here and there that brings down your level by 1% or 2%, but not sort of the 15, 20% we saw drop with the changes he made against Chelsea.
But don't you have to give credit, A, for getting, finding a way, and Bruno Fernandes has really helped this, finding a way of making Pogba look happy and enjoy it and play well. And also, you know, bringing someone like Mason Greenwood on, and it may just be that Greenwood is just a brilliant natural talent, and if we'd managed him, he'd be as good. But you've got to give Solskjaer that credit.
You know, he has done well up to a sort of third, fourth in the Premier League level. I just, you know, the question I'm asking is, can you see them kicking on? No, I can't. I think this is about their peak. Now, maybe they sort of can buy three or four players in the window that transform that squad and give them the depth he needs, and everything suddenly fits together. And I didn't think they'd be this good until they signed Bruno Fernandes. You know, that made a radical difference that I didn't really foresee. So it is possible. I just sort of retain a skepticism about whether he's, yeah, is he an A-grade manager or is he a B-plus manager? And I think he's probably a B-plus manager.
Lars, would you like to give credit to Jamie Vardy, the oldest player to win the Premier League Golden Boot, as you open a can, 33 years of age? That is really impressive, isn't it?
No, it's amazing. And I think I've spoken about this on the pod before. I think actually, I don't think he really gets enough credit right now. I think there is a certain snobbishness about Jamie Vardy because he is the sort of, I mean, there was apparently, according to, I read one of these sort of backgrounds on him, there was a period in his life where it wasn't really going well with the football, and he was considering leaving the game to become like a rep on Ibiza or something. And I think that sort of whole sort of vibe he has, I think there are a lot of sort of clean and tidy university educated middle class boys in press boxes here and there who look at Jamie Vardy and feel like that's not my hero right there. I think sometimes we overlook, for cultural reasons, that what he's doing is quite extraordinary. To have a 33 year old player like him who still never ever gets injured, seems to be, he's still very quick in the sense that he's not as quick as he was a couple of years ago, but he can still get behind people. Extraordinary instincts in the box in terms of finishing, and he doesn't seem to be slowing down significantly. I think it is quite extraordinary. And this sort of image he has, you know, the sort of Skittles vodka and all of this stuff, I think it takes away a little bit the appreciation for what he actually does as a footballer.
I think it's quite strange that when he was considering giving up football, the one thing he thought he would be better at was handing out flyers and using his charm to attract people into popular night spots in Ibiza. Because I think I would not be particularly tempted to go in if he was handing out the flyers and luring me in with the promise of free wicked or tequila.
I went on a post A-level, speaking as a middle-class man who's not really in press boxes, I went on a post-finals trip to Magaluf with that kind of come in here vibe from men outside nightclubs with flyers. I found the whole thing really quite disturbing experience. And I wouldn't recommend it to anyone without wanting to sound like an old man. It was also terribly noisy. Let's move on.
I think every single person, including myself on this pod, is in that bracket of person. But I just think, I do wonder if that is sometimes a barrier for us truly embracing the modern marvel that is Sir Jamie Vardy. And I'm not just saying that because he won me some money. I mean, it is just very impressive what he's been doing.
Let's go to Chelsea Wolves then. Chelsea 2, Wolves 0. So Chelsea, it qualified for the Champions League into the FA Cup final. It has been an absolutely brilliant season for Frank Lampard, Wilson.
He's done okay, yeah. He's won lots of friends. He's done very well bringing through young players. I think the attacking side of the game has been good. I think you've got to give him credit today as well for... the thing he's been really criticised for is the defending. Had they let in one goal today, it would have been Chelsea's worst ever season defensively in the Premier League. So it's the second worst still, which isn't great. They've got massive problems defending cross-set plays. They've got massive problems defending counter-attacks. But today, they needed a draw, and they set out to get a draw. And then they got a little bit more because they got two goals, you know, a brilliant free kick. And then Giroud, who's been great since lockdown. And so, yeah, credit to them for shutting Wolves down and really not looking any bother today. You know, they knew what they needed and they went out to get and got it and got more.
And Giroud has been really, really good. I mean, if you think about the start of the season when Abraham was playing well and Giroud wasn't getting a game and it looked like he might move on, he's been superb in the last part of this season, Barry.
I think Giroud is a terrific player. I think he's unfairly maligned. Is he even unfairly maligned, or is he? He was just out of favour at Chelsea and not getting picked by Frank Lampard.
Well, no, I think there is a feeling with him, certainly from his Arsenal days, that in real high-pressure matches, he loses his bottle a bit and misses big chances in big games. And I think there's a series of big games for Arsenal where that's true. I think that's the criticism. But, you know, he's a man who's won a World Cup. Admittedly, not by scoring any goals, but...
But he did have a shot on target in the World Cup final. It was blocked very close to his foot, but statistics say he didn't, and he definitely got a shot on target. And I'm a big fan of Olivier Giroud. I mean, what is interesting with Chelsea is what on earth they do with all these players. I mean, Werner was in the stands today. What do they do with him and Ziyech and Havertz if he turns up? How do they play everybody, Lars?
Yeah, you might not see a lot more of certainly the ones go attacking-wise, the youngsters, if the Havertz transfer happens as well. I do think that is... And it's funny you mentioned the Giroud-Abraham thing, because, yes, there was a period where Tammy Abraham was scoring a ton of goals and playing really well, and Giroud couldn't get a look in. But there was also a prolonged period, sort of after Christmas, where Tammy Abraham did not score goals, but kept playing, and Giroud couldn't get a look in. But that is what you have to do if you want to give time and space and faith to younger players. You will sometimes have to risk picking them over more established names and safer bets. And, you know, that's the only way they developed, and they've been able to do that this season. Frank Lampard, for all we snigger about his sort of demeanor sometimes, he has done that tremendously well and deserves credit for that. But that is a huge challenge if they bring in a couple of extra A-listers, as they are doing. If you have Hakim Ziyech and Havertz and Pulisic is there and Timo Werner's coming in, yeah, what does happen to Callum Hudson-Odoi in the midst of all that? Probably goes out on loan, I guess.
And Willian as well, who you assume, I mean, I assume he is leaving, but you know, Chelsea have offered him a 2-year deal. He wants a 3-year deal. And Willian, I think, is an underrated part of that side. And I think he's been really good since he came back as well. So I think, you know, his work in terms of leading the press, yeah, I thought particularly the Cup semi-final, he was excellent, as was Mason Mount. And you do sort of think, you know, I can't see how Willian fits in that side at all next year. So I'm even slightly surprised they've offered him a 2-year deal, because it just didn't seem to be a place for him.
Question from Patrick. Has any player in the history of association football been booked for trying to get an opposition player sent off? I guess diving might be that kind of thing. But Rudiger's, he got a slight brush with the wrist from Jimenez. And you know, Jimenez is a strong lad, but I think Rudiger went down a little bit too easy. I mean, it's so ridiculous. And with the number of cameras on you as well, it seems ridiculous that you can't say, sorry, Antonio, you are booked for doing that.
Well, surely you can't you? I mean, it's still simulation. There's nothing that says simulation has to be manufacturing a foul. It can be manufacturing getting slapped or whatever.
All right. Well, then he should have been booked. Barry,
Barry,
you thought the Wolves might get into the Champions League this season. They've just fallen short. How would you review Wolves finishing seventh this season?
I think they've done tremendously well. They're a terrific team of, you know, not necessarily big name players, or certainly players who weren't big name players before they went to Wolves particularly. And they haven't qualified for the Europa League, but they're obviously still in the Europa League, this season's Europa League, which if they win, they could qualify for the Champions League. I would love to see them get a clear run at a tilt for the top four next season, you know, if they weren't in the Champions League, rather than have the distraction of the Europa League. And I know for them it's an enjoyable distraction because they haven't been in it for so long. But they're just a wonderful team on their day to watch. And if I was a Wolves fan, I'd be very excited about what the future holds.
I think it's worth remembering with Wolves that they won none of their first six games in the league this season, and they won just two of their first 11. So they're one of the many, many teams who have really struggled with the extra burden of starting early in the Europa League. And it's something that I'm sure they did everything they could to mitigate against the challenges there, but it does seem to have affected their results. Getting as close to the Champions League as they eventually did, given that they had that start, I think is very, very impressive. And I think not being in the Europa League next season would probably do them a favour.
And, you know, worth mentioning as well that their season started on the 25th of July last year, and it's now the 26th of July this year. Anyway, their defeat means that...
But they have also, Max, had 3 months off.
Yeah, that's so true, but it's quite a nice statistic, isn't it? I'm not looking at detail here. I like the symmetry of it, or the almost symmetry of it.
But I mean, it won't be symmetry, will it? Because they've got Europa League games still to play. So theoretically, they could still be playing until the middle of August.
Thanks for your pedantry, Wilson.
And they'll start next season not winning any games either. And, you know, here we go.
Just go back to your peppers, Wilson. Thank you. Right, that defeat for Wolves means that Spurs creep into the Europa League with a 1-1 draw at Crystal Palace. Sharp finish from Harry Kane, cancelled out by Jeff Schlupp's skull. So what does that mean? How do we view what happened to Spurs this year, Wilson?
Oh, it's excellent news, because, and I really hope they go far in the Europa League, because seeing Jose trying to pretend he cares about it is one of the great points of recent Manchester United seasons.
But hasn't he only been in it twice and won it twice?
Is that true? Maybe it is true.
I think so.
And yet the scorn he showed for Rafa Benitez when he won it with Chelsea was... I suppose if it's so easy for him, he wins it every time he's in it, then maybe he's entitled to show scorn. I don't know. I mean, Tottenham were clearly dreadful the first two or three games back, but then they've suddenly won a load of games. Harry Kane looks back to being really sharp and really good again. There is some kind of logic in whacking the ball long to Harry Kane that isn't there hitting the ball long to Lucas Moura. But I still just sort of feel Tottenham are, that, you know, they've started the Mourinho helter-skelter of doom, and once you're on that helter-skelter of doom, you can't really climb back up to the top.
Lars, have you seen any more?
It is a very cheap shot, but I think it's very much in the spirit of Jose Mourinho to take cheap shots. So we should point out that he did say in 2013, I don't want to win the Europa League. It would be a very big disappointment for me. So, I mean, I guess it's completely fair to change your mind, and I guess circumstances changes. I mean... To be fair to them, they have picked up a reasonable amount of points recently, and they have become sort of less dysfunctional defensively, and they have individuals who can nick goals here and there, and that is the Mourinho way. I mean, I thought a point, I hate doing this because as someone wrote it on Twitter, and I forget who, but someone pointed out that actually in the sort of old Mourinho days, his teams used to play quite well against the lesser teams in the league. Like, they did used to sweep aside lesser opposition. And then it was only sort of in the top games that everyone sort of tune in for and watch 90 minutes of, the big games where he would sort of clamp down and play 87 defensive midfielders and just park all the buses. But his teams used to score a good number of goals and sort of sweep aside opponents. Whereas now, they seem to be a little bit safety first against teams where you wouldn't expect them to be. And that's going to be a dispiriting thing to watch for Tottenham. But one can only hope they develop.
But I think that's a change in wider football, that more and more teams sit deeper and deeper. So I don't know what the figure is for this season, but last season there were 67 games in the Premier League where one team had 70% of all the ball. The season before was 63, the season before that was 36. Whereas in the first 3 years, up to calculated that between 2003-04 and 2005-06, there were only three across those three seasons. So teams sitting really deep, doing nothing other than trying to defend, going into the bunker, has become a much more recognised way of playing, largely because of financial disparities within the league. And I think Mourinho finds that hard to break down. That was an issue at Real Madrid as well. And the big criticism of him initially from players at Real Madrid was they didn't practice what the phrase was used was static attacking. When you have the ball, the opposition's not moving, you've got to work out a way to break them down. And Mourinho's whole thing is he conditions players mentally to make the right decisions and to improvise. He doesn't organise attacks and organise attacking moves as Guardiola or Klopp does. And he thinks football is too random for that ever to be effective. I don't think it's necessarily the case of one's right and one's wrong, but it does feel as if the way modern football has gone, it has gone more towards the practising preset moves in order to put them into effect when the situation demands it.
And now Crystal Palace stopped their run of seven consecutive defeats with that draw. Ed Aaron's writing on Twitter that Roy Hodgson has been speaking about Wilfried Zaha's future. It's a dilemma for the club and for him if he's so set on leaving. We still like him very much. We can't make him like us. It's obviously affected him. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we will discuss the relegation from the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So then, at the bottom, Watford are relegated, Bournemouth are relegated, they join Norwich. Aston Villa stay up by a point after a 1-1 draw at West Ham. Social media currently is just going wild about Aston Villa staying up despite that goal line technology mishap in the first game back after restart. John says, are Villa the luckiest team ever to avoid relegation after the Sheffield United non-goal? And is Dean Smith a hypocrite for not allowing Sheffield United to score after he and his backroom staff went ballistic at Leeds last season when Clich scored? Randy, would Bournemouth ever sue Hawkeye since that one non-goal kept Villa up and put the cherries down? I'm assuming if the league was in the USA, for sure that would happen. And Ryan says, if you were Bournemouth, would you sue the Premier League? What about Hawkeye? And if you were the judge of everything and they did sue, would you rule in their favour? Barry, you're suddenly the court of arbitration for sport. Eddie Howe is sitting opposite you. He has his case. He has the photo of the Sheffield United goal against Aston Villa, the ball and Nyland in the net. What are you ruling?
Well, I would produce counter evidence, mainly of video footage of almost all of Bournemouth's performances this season, and argue that that might have had more of a fact, been more of a factor in them going down.
I mean, as the judge, Barry, you should be slightly more impartial than that, I think, but fair enough.
Well, I would hope that whoever is on the opposite side or the other side of the courtroom would present that evidence, and I think it would certainly help to sway my opinion. That decision didn't send Bournemouth down. Bournemouth's ineptitude sent them down. Villa have had breaks in their favour. They've had breaks go against them. And I think it's ludicrous for anyone to suggest that Bournemouth were hard done by, because for large parts of the season they were pitiful. And it'll be interesting to see what happens now, because I saw Eddie Howe being interviewed by Laura Woods on Sky after their game today. They did their bit, but it wasn't enough. And he, for a while now, he's looked a broken man. And I have a feeling, he said it's a time for reflection. I have a feeling he will leave. He may not, but I think if I was a mate of his or close to him, I'd possibly suggest he might, or he probably should, and go for a change of scenery. I don't think he's damaged his career in any way, but I just think his time is up at Bournemouth, and possibly was up last season. But he doesn't look well. I mean, he looks like he's really been through the ringer, and I'd actually been concerned about him.
Barry, if at any point in the future it seems like my time is up on the pod, will you take me to one side and let me know, be a good friend like that?
Absolutely, Max, yes. Maybe we should have a chat after we're finished recording today.
Look, at the bottom, I mean, it could have been quite exciting at the bottom. There were moments, weren't there? Because Bournemouth went ahead, Villa were doing nothing at West Ham, to be fair, for the first half. Watford gave away a 3-goal lead and then actually started a comeback, and you know, Welbeck had a back heel that was brilliantly saved, and there were all these moments and you thought, you didn't know which team was going to stay up, Lars, and that's kind of what you want on the last day.
Maybe that's just me being very nice. I kind of want everyone to stay up. I feel sorry for everyone who goes down. It's very sad for them. Except, I guess, well, I'm also felt sorry for Norwich, even though it was quite emphatic. Just Alex Tetti looked so sad, and that was upsetting. And I think with Villa, what I just wanted to say is that I think not enough attention has been brought to the mighty Örjan Nyland, who played his part in that non-VAR thing happening by just kind of shielding the ball. I mean, the Hawkeye did say that there were too many limbs involved for the Hawkeye to calculate. So I think I'll be very disappointed if there isn't an Aston Villa fanzine or website or something called Örjan Nyland's right shoulder or something, because that's what should happen there. Clearly, they owe a huge debt to the great goalkeeper from Norway, Örjan Nyland.
They owe it Sorry, I'd say they owe a huge debt to Jack Grealish, Wilson, because he has been absolutely brilliant this season.
Yeah, he's been brilliant. And, you know, there's that soonest thing about, you know, he gets fouled so often because he holds onto the ball too long. Well, he gets fouled a lot because he has the ball a lot in creative areas because Villa play everything through him. And I think, you know, if they're going to stay up next season, they've got to diversify a bit and they've got to work out other ways of playing. But I think they were a bit unlucky that I know Wesley hadn't been brilliant, but losing him as early in the season as they did, you know, that obviously damaged their plans. But, you know, they've taken 10 points from the last four games. It's, you know, it's a 2 weeks ago, they looked down. So I think this is one of the more incredible escapes.
If you were Jack Grealish, would you stay at Villa Park, Barry?
Probably not. If he I mean, I was kind of surprised to see Wilson here because I don't think Grealish has been particularly good since restart. Am I wrong? I thought he could be doing a lot more, but I haven't been watching Villa particularly closely.
No, I still think he's been their best player. I mean, I know Trezeguet's got some valuable goals, but he's still clearly the creative heartbeat of that team.
And it's just for a team down there to have a player you can pass it to, and he can just go past a couple of players and create something almost every time. I mean, he's so good with the ball.
Even the last 10 minutes today, you saw how he got the ball, he held it up. He gets the ball, 30 seconds have gone, because he's good enough to kind of hold it for 30 seconds before winning the throw or getting fouled or... So he just relieves pressure in that sense.
And it's worth noting just how hard it is to be that kind of player in that kind of team, you know, because you really need to make the most out of every time you have possession. And when you try to go past people, you can't fail very often because your team isn't going to have the ball that much. I mean, it's a really, really difficult role he's playing. And I think he deserves a little bit more credit for that.
Okay, maybe I'm being unfair on him and I'm expecting sort of too many Roy the Rovers sort of incidents. But, you know, there was one for him today because he scored their opener. He does have the look about him, though, in my opinion, of like nailed-on Spurs player who will play well quite often but not really win anything.
That was my question, actually, is how far you could see him going. And it's always be interesting to see a player of that quality in a team that are better, so you have more of the ball, there's less pressure on you, you should be able to deliver more.
I think any team would probably be glad to have him, and without wanting to make Tottenham fans cross, I'd like to go see him go somewhere else that a little less Spursy, just to see how good he can be, because he's clearly a very talented player.
Can we talk about Watford? I'd say they gave Arsenal a 3-0 head start, the Hayden Mullins effect. But they almost got back into it. You do wonder, you know, if that Welbeck chance had gone in, that they could.
I mean, Max, that's the third game in a row they've been beaten before they got started, and that's kind of what their problem is. Just you have to win, and you give your opposition a 3-goal head start. Opposition who have little or nothing to play for, apart from getting a breather in before the cup final next weekend. And they deserve to go down. I mean, it was a commendable rally when they could have just thrown in the towel altogether. But when you've done that, I think it's 3 games in a row. Good luck. See you.
Troy Deeney asked, could this be your last game, full stop? He replied, I'm not that old, you cheeky bastards. also nice to see Aurelio Gomez's sort of shaving brush, grey beard, tiny little goatee that he has, having not seen Aurelio Gomez for a long time. Kieran Tierney, the first Scottish player to score for Arsenal since March 1996. Blas, you had your hand up.
I'm just on the subject of Troy Deeney, I would love to see him go to Tottenham to play the Llorente role under Mourinho. I think that would be completely fantastic, just for fun. And I think it would also kind of work.
It's not a terrible idea, is it? Bournemouth won at Everton. John says, is Barry finally in I told you so mode following Bournemouth going down?
No. I mean, they've been pretty dismal and they deserve to go down. I don't take any pleasure in it at all. There are teams I would prefer to have seen gone down, but they had a good run. It's obviously, if a team gets relegated, people behind the scenes might lose their jobs, and that is horrible. Who were we talking? Oh, we were talking to Liam Ridgewell today on our radio show, and he was saying that. Well, he said players. He said players who have any bit of decency about them at all, that is uppermost on their mind when you're in a relegation battle. Is that if you don't turn things around, there are people behind the scenes who earn a lot less money than the players do, who will be out of work. And it's them you're fighting for, as well as the fans, and obviously for selfish reasons. So I take no pleasure in Bournemouth going down, but I do think, you know, sometimes you look at them clinging on and you wonder, what's the point? Would a championship, a season back in the championship, maybe give them a chance to reboot and just... Get some wins under the belt, get confidence back. As long, of course, as they don't do a Sunderland on it or a Charlton and end up getting relegated again. But they have good players who will presumably be snapped up by other teams, and that will, you know, Nathan Ake is one who springs to mind. They'll probably get a lot of money for him. Some three teams have to go. They're one of them. It's quite sad, but life, you know, they'll get over it.
Charlie Baker, who I work with also at TalkSport, he has this theory that these goals that Danny Ings has been scoring for Southampton are England's goals in the Euros that hasn't happened because of COVID-19. But by the same token, Jordan Pickford is throwing them in, and that could have been him in an England shirt, not in an Everton shirt. That was a disastrous goal. It was so soft.
Yeah, it really is. He did make one really good save. I think it was still 0-0. Was it Josh King went through? And that sort of classic save he makes where he kind of sticks his hand up and somehow manages to get the radar right, and then he's got great force in his wrist. So they like the penalty save against Colombia. But yeah, it's no good making a brilliant save and then letting in a goal like that. So he's got credit in the bank, and Southgate clearly likes him, and the fact he's good with his feet gives him a slight advantage over Nick Pope, but he's got to stop letting in soft goals like that. Sorry, I just slowed down to Barry speed there.
You really did, didn't you?
Is it fair, say he hasn't done anything wrong in an England shirt, is it fair for him to be dropped on the strength of club performances? Or does Southgate have to wait for him to have a horror show in an English shirt
I don't think you should ever be reactive like that. I don't think you should ever sort of wait for the person to make the mistake. You know, Southgate's got to decide whether the package of attributes that Pickford brings, which is a capacity for brilliant saves, a very sort of bubbly, buoyant personality, a great confidence playing with the ball at his feet, so an ability to play behind a high line, whether that, even when you take into account the fact he is fallible, still outweighs what the other goalkeepers, Pope and Henderson and whoever, what they offer. I don't think it's a question of sort of... If you wait for him to make a mistake, you end up sort of picking him in a friendly and hoping he makes a howler there so you can then legitimately drop him for the competitive game. And that's not a way to manage anything.
I mean, there are Nations League games before next season starts in this slightly ludicrous and so understandable, but at the same time ludicrous close season after the Champions League final finishes. It's interesting to see who Southgate picks for those games. Now, this game, by the way, in the UK was on Sky Sports Golf because Sky Sports doesn't have enough football channels, and it would have been harsh to take off a test match to put it on Sky Sports Cricket.
Genuinely interested by this because the British Masters started on Wednesday, yeah. So it finished yesterday. Was that done purely to clear up Sunday for the football?
I don't think so. I mean, other people joked that Crystal Palace shouldn't have been on Sky Sports Action either. And something else was on Sky One as well.
Did you watch the game on Sky Golf? Because with the commentators like talking in very hushed tones.
Yes, Jamie Carragher was whispering on the touchline.
Yeah, and Gokom is there looking for a pass for it. No, he's already hit that one.
Absolutely.
Well, it's like that. That could be there for 90 minutes.
No, is the answer. But it's a nice idea.
Did they have someone holding a corner flag in case the ball rolled towards it so they could pull it out of the ground?
I mean, I did this on the radio of ideas. I love the idea of heavy rough instead of touchlines. Huge fan of Bournemouth letting Everton play through at some point during the game. And obviously, Americans just shouting in the goal at all times during the match.
I want a moat instead of the heavy rough, instead of the touchline. Let's get the water in, and I want sand traps in the 16-yard boxes.
But John Beck did put bunkers in the corners, didn't he?
Literally did, yes.
On the subject, sorry, just sticking with this game, Max, briefly, someone asked if I was in I told you so mode regarding Bournemouth finally going down. I'm not, but I'll tell you, I am a little bit in I told you so mode over Richarlison, who continues to leave me resolutely unimpressed. I got an awful pasting from some Everton fans for suggesting he might not be worth the 40 million or 45 or whatever they paid for him. I still think he's all right, but he's certainly no world beater.
Now, I thought you couldn't be in I told you so mode because this is the first season where you haven't predicted Bournemouth would go down.
right.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the pointless fixtures and do any other business. Part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's just round up the other fixtures, chat a little bit about the sides that were playing. Liverpool won 3-1 at Newcastle. So Liverpool matched Manchester City's all-time record of 32 wins in a single Premier League season. We've talked to the top a bit about how well Liverpool have done. A word on Divock Origi, because that might be his last game and last goal for Liverpool. And he's had a slightly odd time there, but he's scored two of their most important goals, Wilson.
Yeah. I mean, he had that habit where he just kept scoring when they really... I mean, even the goal at Newcastle last year, which, in the wider scheme of things, doesn't really matter, but they desperately needed a winner, and he got it. I think he's one of those slightly odd figures who he could easily just drift into complete obscurity now, and in 20 years, people will be going, who's that player who scored that goal against Barcelona? Or who scored in the Champions League final? So, yeah, it's been a very... I don't know. I mean, maybe he is really good, and it's just that when you have a front line of Salah and Firmino and Mane, who are that good and work that well together, maybe it's just very hard to break into it. Maybe he will go somewhere else and score hatfuls of goals. But I don't know. There's a clumsiness to him that even though he scores goals, you sort of think he's not quite at the very highest level.
Hmm. Jordan Henderson won Football Writers Association Player of the Year. And Barry, all the fans of all the clubs were delighted for him, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. There was no outcry at all from Manchester City fans in particular who thought Kevin De Bruyne should have won the award. And there's a small vocal minority of City fans on the social media who really don't like football writers but suddenly seem to have decided that this award football writers give out annually is the most important piece of silverware in football. So they were particularly outraged. I mean, Wilson is an advocate of this and I tend to agree. I'm not that fussed who wins because it's an individual gong in a team sport. I wouldn't begrudge Jordan Henderson at all. I can see why the City fans think Kevin De Bruyne should have won, but ultimately it really matters not one whit who wins the award.
Sadio Mane scored a lovely goal, and probably, Lars, he's been Liverpool's best player this season, hasn't he?
I suppose you can make that case. I mean, it is an odd thing in the sense that Liverpool have been far and away the best team in the league. They really run away with it. But I guess maybe they would say that is a positive. It's kind of hard to look at the team and say which is the sort of standout best individual player there. You heard the sort of the Mane, Salah, Van Dijk. I don't know. I think it very much, again, in the spirit of Jurgen Klopp, it is very much a case of the team being the star. Though I do think, I mean, Mohamed Salah putting up 19 goals and 10 assists again. I feel like we kind of underrate some of his seasons just because he had that one year where he scored like 170 goals or something. And since then, he's been enormously good. I mean, yeah, 32 goals in the league and then 22 last year and 19 now. Like 22 goals in the league for even for a wide attacker and then 19 goals in Tennessee. That is a tremendous return. And just because he's not putting up 30, I think we shouldn't underestimate how much of an achievement that is.
And now it turns out that Rafa Benitez got one more point than Steve Bruce managed to get this season. So does that mean that Steve Bruce's friends in the media should stop saying what an amazing season he's had, Wilson? Or would you say that he got one point fewer than Rafa means they're pretty much on a par?
I don't think it's easy at all to assess what Bruce has done at Newcastle, because the circumstances have been incredibly difficult in that he's obviously a fan of the club. He's dreamed of having this job or of joining Newcastle in some form from being a teenager, or maybe earlier. And when he finally gets the opportunity, he comes in and is perceived as being the sort of patsy of a hated regime. And that is obviously one of the reasons that he, a certain section of Newcastle support will never sort of appreciate what he does. I think their football has often been pretty stale and pretty tired and pretty unadventurous this year. You could argue with the squad he's got, he doesn't really have any option. I can certainly see why Newcastle fans would think that Benitez was likely to take them further than Bruce ever will. But I think in difficult circumstances, he's done fine while understanding why he's not universally popular among Newcastle fans.
Man City 5, Norwich 0. David Silva, his final Premier League game for City after 10 years and 13 trophies. De Bruyne scored two absolutely beautiful goals in this game. Arguably adding fuel to fire that he probably is the best player in the league this season. Man City ended on 102 goals. I've seen quite a few lists doing the rounds of underachievers this season, and Tottenham are in it and Arsenal are in it. And Man City are in it as well. Is that fair, Lars?
I mean, I guess in total, I think the confusing thing about Man City is I think you can make a case for them at their best being better than Liverpool at their best. But they've been inconsistent and they've had this sort of defensive weakness that's troubled them. But they on their day, they can absolutely blow teams away in a way no one else in the league really can. And scoring 102 goals is no small feat. And I agree that in a sort of cold sort of, all else being equal, Kevin De Bruyne probably is the best player in the league at the moment. And no, they're really good. It's just they haven't been, they've had a couple of weird games where they just couldn't put away their chances. And they've had a couple of games where some defensive frailties have been shown up. They did go into the season, I'm sure it's been said a ton of times before, but they did go into the season light at centre half. And then when they got a long-term injury to Laporte in addition, it's been tough for them. And I don't think this means Man City are broken, or if they can strengthen in the right areas over the summer, there's every reason to suggest they could be back and impervious again next season.
Despite the quarantine from people coming from Spain, Real Madrid have got a reprieve to come and play that game against Manchester City, Lars. How do you see that going if you were a betting man?
So the odd thing here is that Real Madrid have been very different in Spain. Real Madrid have been sort of weirdly underwhelming in the place of watch them play. Then they haven't impressed that much, but they've just been getting the job done game after game after game in the final stretch of the Spanish season. So they've been very much the opposite of Man City. Man City, if they get it right, if they play to the best of this team's ability, could absolutely trounce this Real Madrid team. But Real Madrid have so much know-how in these games, so it's really finely poised. And if I said I have a very strong idea of how it'll go, I'd be lying. I mean, it is just it's exactly where you want a cup game for this to be, in that it could go either way. It'll be really exciting to watch.
I think I disagree with Lars about that. I don't think City are better than Liverpool at their best. I think City have scored four or more 11 times this season. So if they get up against a team who can't break their press, City can devastate them. But they have this enormous fragile glass jaw, and any team who's good at breaking has a chance of smacking that. So Wolves have beaten them twice. Liverpool have beaten them. Manchester United have beaten them. Norwich have beaten them. Southampton have beaten them. I think City are a team who, if you look at purely goals for, goals against, it looks impressive. But it's because they're incredibly good at smashing kind of weaker sides. As soon as they come against a team who is good on the break, who's good at getting the ball in behind them. Chelsea, you know, the game when the title was won. City dominated that game for 20 minutes, made a mistake, conceded straight away. Then in the second half, Chelsea kept on troubling them with balls in behind them. So, I think you've got to put the two halves of a team together. I don't think City defensively have been anywhere near good enough this season. Now, the question I think is interesting is that a personnel issue? And clearly it is to an extent a personnel issue. And can it be solved just with a couple of signings? Or is there something in Guardiola's model of pressing which looked devastating 10 years ago? And you think of the 2011 Champions League final and, you know, Alex Ferguson saying afterwards that he'd never seen his team so under pressure, so unable to get the ball. Is what's changed that the personnel there were perfect for that system? Or have we got used to that and Liverpool's pressing has gone to a new stage? Klopp's gegenpressing is better than that, because Liverpool never get, or very rarely get, caught out by those simple balls in behind which trouble City so often.
I think the personnel issues are hard to get away from, no? Because the fact
absolutely they are. Probably,
I would argue that the hardest position in the Guardiola sort of way of playing system is the holding midfielder, right? Because you have to be brilliant in terms of your defensive positioning, in terms of stopping counters, but you often have to be incredibly good at setting the pace of the passing game and this sort of thing. It's very, very few players on the planet who can do that, and Fernandinho was one of them. And because of the problems at centre half, you've had to play him there a bit, and he's gotten older, and this sort of, you have a bit of a problem there. And
yeah, and that's meant Rodri's had to play more than they probably would have liked to have played him in his first season. Yeah, I know, I completely accept all of that. My concern would be that over the past decade, it's been a consistent theme of Guardiola's sides that when they've lost games, it's been for that reason. A
couple more games to race through. Southampton 3, Sheffield United 1, Richard Jolly stat. Che Adams, the only player in Premier League history with 4 plus goals, but none between the 1st of August and the 30th of June. He's the new Danny Ings, Che Adams. And I suppose, look, well done to Southampton for coming back after that 9-0 drubbing by Leicester early in the season, which was just a great day in the horizontal rain on a Friday night. And you just thought they are absolutely finished, and they weren't. And Hasenhüttl has done a great job.
Teams who get hammered very rarely get relegated.
Is that so?
Well, Wigan didn't get relegated when they lost 9-1 to Spurs. Sunderland didn't get relegated when they lost 8-0 to Southampton. Sunderland didn't get relegated when they lost 8-0 to Watford. Sunderland didn't get relegated when they lost 8-0 to West Ham. Getting beat 8-0 is a really good sign if you want to stay up.
What about Ipswich? Didn't they get 9-0?
They might have gone down that season.
What about Palace when Palace didn't?
Well, no, they didn't. They stayed up and got to the cup final.
Absolutely right.
It's basically just, you know, if you can group your goals, you know, if you've got 30 goals to concede in the season, you might as well concede them all in. You might as well lose 3 games 10-0 rather than 30 games 1-0.
I've always thought that. I think that's how it works. Yes, Lars, your hand is up.
Coach, on the subject of pressing, I mean, there's been such a bizarre season for Southampton because only Norwich have taken fewer points at home than they have. But now, at the end of it, only Liverpool and City have taken more points away from home. This is a truly, truly odd season from Southampton. And I guess that's because they're all about sort of the high press and disrupting opponents, but maybe not as good when they have to build the play themselves.
Actually, Watford lost 8-0 this season, didn't they? They went down. So
that is a good point.
It might be I'm talking shit. It
seems unlikely, Jonathan.
Barry, Sheffield United, a one-season wonder, or do you think they've got what it takes to hang around and do something next season?
Why don't you ask me at the end of next season?
Okay.
When I will have a better idea. They've had a terrific season. Chris Wilder, hugely impressive. I suppose you got to give Jurgen Klopp the nod for manager of the year over him because Liverpool won the title so impressively. But Wilder's been magnificent. I wouldn't say he's made a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but when you look at the players who were coming up, I knew very little about most of them at the start of this season, and I've been hugely impressed by so many of them. None more so than two Irish lads playing for them. So that's really heartening to see just from a more sort of selfish perspective.
I've set a reminder in my phone for the 17th of May, 2021 to say, ask Barry about Sheffield United. So
okay,
let's see if we're recording at that point, if we're both still on earth and alive, amongst other things. Burnley 1, Brighton 2. Yves Bissouma scored the goal of the day, didn't he? Absolutely hammered it. Connolly with a great finish for the winner. Chris Wood took his goal beautifully as well. Would you like to review Graham Potter's season, Lars?
I'm excited that they stayed up, because I think he's done something that's really difficult, in that he's taken a team that was used to playing quite sort of defensive, reactionary football under Chris Hughton. And there's nothing wrong with that. They were just newly promoted. They had to stay up, you know, not being a snob about it. But they were playing quite direct, and, you know, and Graham Potter came in and tried to make them a much more sort of possession orientated side. You know, playing out from the back with some centre halves who are maybe not used to doing that. And I, to be honest, I thought it was going to go wrong. There's so many ways, and that could end in catastrophe and relegation, and it hasn't. They've secured a place. They've got quite a few interesting players in that team, and I look forward to seeing what they can do next season.
My question on Burnley, Jonathan, who, if you could only take one of their centre forwards, would you take? Wood, Barnes, Rodriguez? You're not going to take Vidra, are you? But which of those three, who are you taking? Barnes, Wood, or Rodriguez?
Where am I taking him?
You're taking them
nice on holidays.
No, firstly, you're taking them to your club that you're taking over. You've just been given the job at West Brom, and you can have one of those three.
It's close between Wood and Barnes, probably Wood.
Okay, and now a mini break to Northern Tenerife.
I don't know, does Jay Rodriguez speak Spanish, or does he have a Spanish name?
It's a good question.
But anyway, either way, it would help him to get in touch with his Hispanic heritage.
J. Enrique Rodriguez, of Spanish descent through his father and paternal grandparents, born in Burnley.
I'm guessing he speaks Spanish.
Yeah, he'll be able to do it.
Yeah, I'd definitely take him to Northern Tenerife, because, yeah, just to... I mean, my Spanish is okay. I can deal with waiters and that, but, you know... It's always useful to have somebody who can speak it properly.
Is there an option to take Sean Dyche? I kind of want to go wine tasting with Sean Dyche. No, I think that'd be sensational.
It's not an option for the question.
Oh, I'm damn afraid. It.
Don't be ridiculous, Lars.
that would make this a completely silly and pointless exercise.
Yes, producer Sammy looking, going, have we not done enough already today? Okay. any other? Chris says, are Burnley getting enough credit for their season, given they finished level on points with Sheffield United? I think Burnley get a lot of credit, but maybe you can have a little bit more credit just to even you up with Sheffield United. The Premier League have confirmed that the league will recommence on the 12th of September, finish on May the 23rd, just 6 days after I asked Barry about Sheffield United. The EFL will restart on the same date, and the regular season will end on May the 8th and 9th. Peter says, firstly, a big heartfelt thanks. 2020 has been a season, brackets and year, like no other, and the pod has been a source of joy and normalcy. Cheers, everybody. He wants to know, goal of the season, any advances on Heung-min Son versus Burnley?
Well, I had to answer this for the paper, so I might as well give the same answer. I find it very hard to remember stuff these days. And so I think with something like goal of the season, certainly if you're in our position, it's got to be a game you're at, and it's got to be a goal that sort of had an air of specialness around it. And the goal that really stands out, and you know, it's technically an okay goal, but just for the atmosphere, the glorious sense of inevitability just before he struck the ball, was Matty Longstaff's goal against Manchester United in the rain.
Great choice.
Back in October, that Jethro Williams cut in the left side of the box, created the space, rolled it back. It was absolutely hammering with rain, so you just knew if he got on target, it was probably going to go in. And it was David De Gea, so you knew if he was on target, it was probably going to go in. And there was this beautiful space in front of him, and he thought, just keep it down. He kept it down, and you know, the celebrations were brilliant, and you know, his debut, wasn't it? And kind of his parents were in the crowd, and Andy Carroll sort of hugging him and taking him to the Gallagher. It was just a lovely moment, and I very much enjoyed that goal.
There was a question about VAR, but we made the VAR chat stop last week, so that's good, isn't it? So, William, question for you, Barry. Who's going down next season?
Oh, crikey. Whoever wins the playoff final, because they're going to have very little time to get their ducks in a row before the season starts again. I don't know. West Ham, probably. And because they've shown enough promise in the closing stages of this season to suggest they will be, once again, diabolically bad next season. And, yeah, it's very difficult to say, because teams will get off to bad starts, managers will get sacked and replaced. But, you know, I think Villa were pretty lucky to stay up this season. And they may well go as well. But I'm not going to write anyone off before the season starts, from whoever wins the playoff final.
And finally,
he'll probably go on to win the league.
Finally, Alistair says, has Wilson finished his peppers yet, or is he now experiencing a capsicum-initiated trauma that has left him locked into a Langdon-based diet?
No, I've been having at least one pepper every day since, because I've got quite a few to go through. I think I've learned a lot. I think it's not impossible. I'm not saying I won't be coming back offering double or quits to Barry in a month or so. I've got something extraordinary happened that day. I'm not going to tell you what it was, but I
think we heard it.
No, I've worked out the secret of this. There's a trick. There's a food stuff you can take with a pepper, but it negates its effect. Also, the calorific content is not very big. You know, it's under 1,000 calories, 30 peppers.
What's the food stuff?
It's flapjack. I just don't want other people doing it.
It's flapjack.
Well, I felt pretty ropey when I finished, but I had this weird craving for flapjack. Okay. And fortunately, I had some left over because at the minute, you don't get a cricket tea, so you have to take your own food.
Of course.
Just take one of those little tubs of flapjacks because you have two or three of them and that'll do. And I had three little squares. And honestly, I could have attacked the peppers again. 10 minutes later, I could have attacked the peppers again. So I will experiment with this. I am also going to do some pre-chopping. I think one of the things you've got to do is go hard early, very much the Yvonne Murray approach to. I'll have a little experiment and we'll come back in 5 or 6 weeks and we'll see where we are.
Excellent news.
So go hard or go hurl is what you've learned.
Well, look, that'll do for today's pod. Just to note that Swansea have beaten Brentford in the first playoff semi-final. I'm off for the next two pods, but Faye will join Barry along with Jacob Steinberg, Jonathan Faduba on Tuesday. They'll look back at that win for Swansea and what happens in the Cardiff-Fulham game, as well as plenty more besides. But for now, thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Lars.
Bye, Max.
Faye with you on Tuesday, Ellis hosting on Thursday. I'll be back next Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.